How is it that we find ourselves surrounded by such complexity, such elegance?
The genes of you and me,
the genes of you and me,
we're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA. We're all made of DNA.
Hello, you're listening to DNA Today, a genetics podcast and radio show. I'm your host, Kira Dineen. DNA Today informs you on what's happening in the genetic world. During my broadcast, I educate you, the public, on genetic and health topics through different types of shows, event coverage like today's episode, news stories, book movie reviews, and interviews. Guests in the past and in the future will include genetic counselors, researchers, patient advocates, and professors in the field of genetics. Yesterday, I attended the Forum on Healthcare Innovation hosted by Jackson Laboratories in Farmington, Connecticut, right on the UConn Health campus. And this conference was full of healthcare professionals and covered different aspects of healthcare. There was conversations about direct consumer genetic testing, where you order the test yourself, something like Ancestry.com or 23andMe, or kind of some of the top carriers of those companies. Microbiome was also talked about, and this is a really interesting newer field, looking at the bacteria that lives in us and on us. So it's kind of a different thing. It kind of boggles your mind when you think about how we're actually not mostly human. We're mostly bacteria. So we'll get into that later in the show. Also talk about patient advocacy and other healthcare technology. And the focus of the conference was to take all this information and say, where are we headed in the future? Where do we want to be? And kind of merging those two ideas so that we have a plan to really get us to where we want to be. So I'll be sharing highlights from some of these awesome presentations that I attended, including from Francis Collins, who's the NIH director. He was one of the keynote presenters, and so it really was such a pleasure to be able to be in the audience and hear directly from him. He's kind of a celebrity in these fields. So one of the first presentations was from James Liu, who is a representative from Helix. And so he talked a lot about different types of kind of genetic testing and kind of where we're headed with it and the information around it. What are we doing with it? And so one of his main points was to talk about how we are having costs dramatically drop, and it's really changing the field and how much we're able to do. Of in the past, we were not able to really do as much as we can today with the money we have. You know, the money goes a lot further. So the cost of sequencing back in 2004 would cost $22 million. $22 million. Now compare that to today in 2017, $800. So go from $22 million to $800. That is a huge decrease in cost. And because of that, we're able to really sequence more people for less money, and we can do it a lot faster. So really having this happen over, you know, the course of time, and the cost is going to continue to decrease. And so we're going to be able to do much more and sequence many more people. Another thing he talked about was how there are all these small developers that are designing these really creative apps. And some of them just kind of blew my mind how just cool and interesting they are, just for people to download and play with them themselves. One of which is called Neanderthal, and this actually shows you what percentage Neanderthal you are and kind of what genes you have that can be traced back. So that's pretty cool. Obviously, you need to have your genome sequence for that one, but interesting to see, and kind of one of those entertainment aspects of going through genetic testing and all that. Another is Baby Glimpse, which allows you to combine traits from two different people to generate what their baby might look like. So this is something that, you know, many of us have done in middle school, high school, whatever. You go on one of those websites and you upload two pictures of people, and they kind of morph the images and kind of put it on a baby. And so this takes genetics much more into account in taking a lot of your traits and kind of then doing Punnett squares, I suppose, in their algorithms, and kind of coming up with what a potential baby would look like. So that one is just another fun one, but goes to show that all of these, you know, small companies, these companies are run by less than 10 people and able to develop these applications. And genetics is having an impact not only in just healthcare and everything, but goes far beyond. So, you know, we talk about ancestry, we talk about, you know, looking at Neanderthal. So that's a little bit of ancestry in there too, and Baby Glimpse and all that. So there's different types of products being produced based on the research and everything that's happening. And another emerging kind of platform happening is participatory research. And what's happening here is that a lot of people are able to participate in research and aren't exactly human subjects anymore, but really seen as participants and partners in research. So that's kind of an angle that's changing as we evolve in healthcare and as our research is evolving, especially with data sharing, of having patients able to have more data and have access to that. That's something that's really changing, that, you know, you look back a few decades and that wasn't happening as much, but now patients are more informed than ever and it can really help with different decisions they're making. And so the more that patients have access to their electronic medical records, this is going to drive massive opportunity for research because people are going to be more interested in participating because they're going to get more out of it. That if they're taking part in this research study, they're going to get information that they can actually potentially use in making healthcare decisions. So one of the major points that was stressed during this conference was working collaboratively and being able to pool resources and pool skills together to really look at long-term goals and coming together on bigger projects, of not having so much different competitiveness in the field, but much more collaboration to really get to our end goal. And another thing that I mentioned before is direct consumer genetic testing. And this is really advancing. We see commercials all the time for 23andMe or for the Ancestry ones. And with more research, we're more confident on results that are coming back to patients and, you know, and the interpretations that we're making based on those results of saying, all right, you have this mutation, but what does that actually mean? Is that bad? Is that good? What does this mean in terms of maybe your risk for cancer or risk for other disease development? And as I said before, all testing is getting cheaper, including this direct consumer. Another different presentation was from Lisa Anderson from Genome Medical, and she talked more about how what our workforce is looking like and what our patient community is looking like. So genetics and genomic medicine has the potential to improve patient outcomes and reduce costs of care. Obviously, the more we know, the further we go. So that's all great, but it's not accessible, even though the technology exists for a lot of these things, that, you know, we're coming up with these very innovative ideas and innovative technology, but just because we have it doesn't mean that it's actually able to reach everyone and everybody's going to be able to take advantage of this. So what her company is doing is providing real-time access to genetic counseling through telecommunication, so through, you know, computer video conferencing and technology like that, so that they're able to reach much more people. Currently, genetic testing is growing at 20 to 25% yearly. Now, the workforce is only growing by 3%. That's right, only 3%. So this is creating a huge gap that is continuously growing as we're projecting. And so what her company, Genome Medical, is doing is taking, you know, genetic counselors and saying, all right, let's pair you up with patients. And they don't have to be right in front of them. They don't have to travel hours to get to a facility for those that live in more rural areas. So this is her company's kind of looking at this problem of the gap between genetic counselors and other genetic experts and the patients, the sheer number of patients that need to be seen and have their testing explained to. And it's true that most patients are seen in community settings, but most genetic experts work in large institutions, usually in large cities. So where the genetic experts are not exactly where the patients are in a lot of cases. And she had an interesting prediction that kind of makes me think a little bit, that within 5 years, every cancer patient will be sequenced. And what this means is that they'll have genetic testing, and not just testing for one thing, but more their genome to be sequenced, or their exome, depending on the level of kind of coverage, we call it. And so she's thinking that there will be that every cancer patient 5 years will have germline and somatic testing, which means that their cancer cells will be sequenced as long as they're normal cells. And so interesting to hear from people that are really immersed in the field and seeing how new technology is changing the field, and also what their predictions are for the future, and saying that within 5 years, every cancer patient is going to be sequenced. That may not come true, but then again, you know, they're basing that on a lot of information. So it's interesting to see kind of where they're taking it. Another presentation was from Andrew Urey from ACTx. And so he talked about those direct consumer genetic testing being used as a potential to screen for drug compatibility. So that kind of sounds like, whoa, what's happening? So drug compatibility is saying, all right, if you take this drug, will it actually affect you? Will it really work on you? And it's not the same for everybody. And this is called pharmacogenomics, looking at people's genomes and saying, all right, if we give you this medication, will it even work? And for a lot of medications, we've discovered certain genes, and you know how they are sequenced, or really what their sequence is, can establish whether a drug will even work. We don't even need to test the actual drug on the patient. We can look at their genetics and say, oh, drug A is going to work, but drug B won't work. And a great example of the potential impact here is in mental health. If someone has depression, the kind of standard protocol is to give them a medication like an SSRI, wait a few weeks, it could be 6-12 weeks, it could be a long time, and then we see if it works. So it's a trial and error. It's like, let's throw these meds at you. Let's see if you, you know, see an improvement in your depression weeks later. But what pharmacogenomics does is says, all right, let's take a blood sample and let's actually test it and say, all right, we're going to sequence you from your blood and we're going to see if this drug is actually going to work. And so 90% of patients have a potential drug genomic interactions. So 90% of people, this could actually work. So looking at that, that's going to be much more efficient than, you know, it could go on for years for people with depression and other mental health illnesses to say, all right, let's try this drug and this drug and this drug. And it's very, very frustrating. So to actually be able to use this would have a massive impact and really alter how patients are diagnosed completely. You would actually being able to utilize this would really have a major impact. And that goes for not only mental health illnesses, but other types of drugs. Mental illness is kind of one to really highlight because of that lag in try this drug for weeks, doesn't work. All right, try this drug, doesn't work. Try this drug. So that's really a great example, but it goes beyond mental health. You know, all types of diseases we can, and cancer, we can test this on. And so the feature presentation was from Francis Collins, who's the director of the National Institute for Health. And so he talked about a lot of different projects in our recent history and that are ongoing right now, and kind of, you know, seeing kind of where we were only a few decades ago to where we are today now in the present. And so he kind of started his presentation talking about how we have the National Institute for Health, but it's also the National Institute for Hope is kind of his outlook on it. And so he kind of came up with three reasons for hope. And one is for uncovering life's foundations. Second is for translating discovery into health. And the third is to move forward together. And so he started by talking about his involvement and kind of just what occurred with the Human Genome Project. And for those that maybe don't remember or are, you know, like familiar with, oh, Human Genome Project, we did something very landmark there. Human Genome Project was when we actually sequenced the human genome for the first time. And this took a while. And it was controversial at the time for those maybe not really in science, because they were like, is this really the best use for our resources? How much money are we going to pour into this? Are we even going to get something that we can use? And once we get it, what do we do with it? You have 3.2 billion base pairs. how do you even begin to read this? How do you begin to translate this? So those were kind of some thoughts at the time while this project was underway. And an interesting aspect of the project while he was talking that I was thinking about was how during this project, data sharing was a major aspect. And it was during this time that they would upload new data that they had, you know, extracted from the day every 24 hours. So instead of waiting, you know, a decade to come up with all this data and then publish it, they were like, no, 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 we need to give researchers access to everything that we know every 24 hours. So researchers were able to take the information and, you know, portions of the genome that they had been sequencing and then use it in their labs. So as this project was ongoing, researchers were able to use it at the same time. They didn't have to wait around for years for it to officially be published. And so the Human Genome Project really was such a monumental project in the trajectory of where and how genomics have really impacted healthcare. And, you know, we see more and more about genetics and through different drug commercials or 23andMe commercials or, you know, your doctor mentions it. Genetics comes up much more than it used to, and it's much more of a household kind of concept than it used to be. Another interesting project that is ongoing, so the Human Genome Project finished, and they have a draft for it and everything, and we've been using it since, so that's concluded. But a project that started in 2008 and is ongoing is the Human Microbiome Project. And this is very intriguing. The mission of it is to generate resources for comprehensive characterization of the microbiome. So you're like, what does that even mean? So the microbiome is, if we compare that to the genome, so they're both omes. The genome, human genome, is looking at all of the genetic information that's human in your body. Whereas the microbiome is actually all of the like microbiology and all of the different bacteria and everything that's actually living on your body, like on your skin or in you, like in your stomach and the lining of your stomach and everything. And people might think of this when you hear like yogurt is bacteria and it's a good bacteria, that there is good bacteria. A lot of people say, you know, oh, bacteria, that's bad. We have to get rid of that. And, you know, Purell commercials will talk about, kills 99.9% of bacteria. Not all bacteria is good. Actually, most of bacteria is good and beneficial to us and helps us digest. And so looking at what bacteria actually lives in us and sequencing their genomes and realizing, you know, percentages of what type of bacteria is mostly in there and is there a presence of this type of bacteria. That's kind of what the Human Microbiome Project is all about. And so it started in 2008, and that was phase one, which ended 2013. And phase two started in 2014, and it's ongoing. So I'll get into a little bit more about the microbiome later, covering a different presentation. And another kind of point that Francis Collins made during his presentation, and his eyes kind of lit up during it, was about CRISPR. And I've mentioned CRISPR on the show before. It's a gene editing technology. And a very important kind of concept to this is that CRISPR was discovered from basic research. And this is huge. People often say, oh, basic research isn't worth the money. You know, basic research is basically studying kind of, you could see it as random different things that you're kind of just exploring and learning. Whereas other research is kind of taking a study and saying, all right, we're testing this hypothesis or you know, this theory or not theory, but this hypothesis. And so that your data collecting is a lot more straightforward. But this goes to show that basic research is so, so important in us coming into the future and looking at new things and new discoveries. So we've gone from basic research to CRISPR and just years ago to now being in human trials. So this has really been an expedited process compared to if you look at other types of technologies and other types of discoveries. And it's a revolution in medicine and biotechnology. And Francis Collins predicts that in 5 years, CRISPR could cure the first molecular disease, and he's thinking it will be sickle cell disease. And for those that don't remember, sickle cell disease occurs in someone that only has one base pair change in their genome. So remember, we're looking at 3.2 billion base pairs. And when only one is changed, someone can have sickle cell. And so there's lots of different molecular diseases like this. And so he's thinking that CRISPR could actually cure the first molecular disease and have it be sickle cell. So this would be monumental to have, you know, something come from basic research to years later actually curing a molecular disease. And CRISPR is super interesting. If you're interested in learning more about it, I have a lot of episodes kind of talking about the basics of it, kind of the future and what we're currently using it for. So you can definitely check that out, dnapodcast.com. But anyway, so the other point that Francis Collins brought up is the All of Us Project. And it was formerly known as the Precision Medicine Initiative, but kind of renamed it and remarketed as All of Us to be a little bit more inclusive. And it's happening now as opposed to 10 years ago or 10 years in the future for many reasons, one of which is, as I mentioned, the insane drop in the cost of sequencing. I'll say it again because it's mind-blowing. 2004, it cost $22 million to sequence a genome. $22 million, whereas today, in 2017, it's only $800. And as the years go on, that price will continue to drop. And so because of this, the All of Us project here has been able to lift off, and it started in beta in May 2017, and it will have a full launch in spring 2018. And what the project is having a goal of 1 million people, 1 million participants, which it's important that they're called participants, not human subjects. They're partners in this research. They're very important and an integral part of the process. And so what this is taking data from all of these people and taking different samples and everything and being able to learn from that and extract data and kind of make connections to then be able to individualize care that in a lot of ways our healthcare system is looking at finding a drug or a treatment or something that works for a large group of people. And this is kind of flipping that. And it's saying, all right, people are very different. So we need to figure out a more tailored approach. And it doesn't mean that each person has, you know, their own thing going on. That, oh, this person, we're going to come up with a new treatment idea. It's not quite at that level, but it's at a kind of subgroup level where instead of saying, oh, people that have breast cancer, we'll give them this treatment. But kind of breaking that down a little bit further and saying, what type of breast cancer do you have? What are your genetic results for that breast cancer? And now we can group you in all of these subgroups and say, okay, based on your subgrouping, this drug or this treatment or chemo or radiation or whatever it may be is going to be the best case scenario for you. And so that's this precision medicine that the All of Us project is really bringing together. And you can check out joinallofus.org for updates on it and to learn more about it. That was a very, very general overview of it. And it's exciting to see that the NIH is seeing an increase in funding, $2 billion a year. That's not just for the All of Us program, obviously. That's overall. But we are seeing increases in funding, which hasn't been the case, you know, for last few decades. But it's good to see that the funding is there and growing. And one quote that kind of stuck with me from Francis Collins was that we don't have a healthcare system, it's a sick care system. And this really kind of brings the idea up of that we're very much of something happens and we treat it. And flipping that and saying, let's prevent things from actually happening, that's going to be a lot more cost-effective. It's going to save a lot of people's lives. Let's not even talk about money, looking at patients' lives, quality of life. And so the way that we're going to be able to switch this from a sick care system to a healthcare system and a prevention system and not just a treatment system is to show evidence and data that this is actually effective in all of these different areas, and probably mostly money because money talks. But being able to have that switch is going to be, you know, vitally important. And so I said I would get back to the microbiome. And so later in the conference, there was a few different presentations on the microbiome. One by George Weinstock, who actually works at Jackson Laboratories, where this conference was hosted. And he talked about how there were 754 studies currently published on clinicaltrials.gov that actually list the microbiome. So it's a lot bigger than people actually think of how much research we actually have in the microbiome. Again, the Human Microbiome Project started back in 2008, so it has been going, but in terms of science, that's relatively new. And what's kind of happening with this microbiome and looking at the bacteria in our system is really looking at the relationship between, you know, disease and what our microbiome looks like, and kind of trying to figure out, okay, what's a healthy microbiome? And that's not exactly a straightforward thing because it's, as George Weinstock explained it, it's enormous plasticity. The microbiome has enormous plasticity. And what that means is that it's constantly changing based on our food, environment, and other factors. It's not as fixed as our human DNA. When you're born, you have the DNA you have, and that's not really going to change. Whereas the microbiome changes completely. One interesting study that he brought up was looking at Olympic athletes and their microbiome. And kind of the quest here is to, again, look for that kind of golden microbiome. What's the best? Maybe not what's normal, but what's the best? And so far they've found a bacteria common with most of these athletes, which is called M. smithii. And so it's interesting, and I'm curious to see more studies and publications that come out about the microbiome, because there is a lot of disease linked to kind of, you know, the bacteria that we have and everything, and just how that works in healthy people too. You know, a super healthy person or someone that's just kind of normal average, and seeing different relationships. And this is definitely going to be a field that is really going to expand in the next few years of, you know, more and more research and research that we're really able to use in different things. Lauren Ambrigo from AEO Biome talked about how her company has an FDA approved product, which was actually constructed from microbiome research. And this product is called Mother Dirt. And so it's designed to be compatible with the microbiology of the skin. So instead of taking off all the bad bacteria, all the good bacteria, it kind of works with it in a kind of symbiosis, and there's no preservatives in it. And she also brought up the idea of personalized products and how that would be just a huge market to kind of look at, because everybody's microbiome is a little bit different, to, again, kind of look at that precision medicine almost, to personalize it and make it much more tailored to different groups of people and different ethnic groups and things like that. So the conference overall was full of information, and I barely scratched the surface here, but wanted to share with you guys different things that I learned and kind of ideas that were being shared. One other thing I want to mention is that Genetic Counseling Awareness Day is on November 9th. This is the first. And you can follow the day's events on social media with hashtag IAmAGeneticCounselor. I'll also provide links in today's show notes and on DNApodcast.com. So that's all you need to know, DNApodcast.com. It'll get you all the other information on there. But that about wraps up today's episode of DNA Today. Again, you can go to DNApodcast.com for information. And for information about Jackson Laboratories, who hosted this wonderful conference, you can check out jax.org. That's jax.org. And also at Jackson Labs on Twitter. They are very active on there and post lots of interesting stuff. I'm on Twitter at DNA Podcasts. If you would like, you can follow me there. Thanks for listening, and join me next week to learn and discover new advances in the world of genetics.